starting to count down at six. I was like, all right, that's what a weird number, right? When was the last time you're like, all right, let's do this? And six, five, like that's a, anyway, that's somebody who designed this who was like, this is what they do in Hollywood, but they've never been to Hollywood.
Welcome to Let Loose Comedy's Funny Business, a podcast. My name's Chris Williams. I'm the host and founder of Let Loose Comedy in Santa Barbara, California. I'm an up-and-coming stand-up comic, and I love everything comedy. I love talking about comedy. I love doing comedy. I love watching comedy. Ugh, I'm obsessed. It might be a problem. But here's the deal. I started this podcast because I felt like people do not know enough about the world of stand-up comedy. At one time, somebody actually told me that they thought that, you know, you just kind of practice your jokes for a year or two, and then maybe you apply to have a Netflix special. And I wish it worked that way, but it does not. So with that in mind, I said, how can I educate people on the world of stand-up comedy, and how can I learn more about the business, both the good and the bad sides of, well, this funny business? And the truth was, there's no better way than to just talk to other comics. So this podcast is me talking to some great comics, and I am so excited to introduce my first guest, Leah Rudick. Leah is an actor, writer, comedian based out of Los Angeles. She's the co-creator and co-star of the critically acclaimed web series Made to Order. She began performing sketch comedy in New York with her sketch duo Skinny Bitch Jesus Meeting that was at UCB and Caroline's and even The Pit. She also has a pretty solid social media following where she does some excellent character work. I'm going to give you her handle so you can check her out after. But without further ado, here's my conversation with Leah Rudick. Leah, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Absolutely. I'm so excited. I'm very, very excited to have you. Excited to talk to you. And I mean, so I actually knew of you before the personal relationship that we have now had. And most of that comes from your social media, which I'm sure a lot of people reach out to you. You have so many followers on everything. And I just want to know, what made you start your social media campaign of these characters? And I just want to start right there. We're going to work backwards because your characters are insane. Tell me about them.
Well, I started, I think, as many people of my age range did during the pandemic, because I wasn't performing live, and I need some kind of creative outlet. And actually, it was my brother who kept being like, "You gotta join TikTok. You gotta join TikTok." And I was like, "No, TikTok is for children, right, and I don't dance." And he kept being like, "No, it's like it's this new play. Like you can have this organic growth that you can't anywhere else." And finally, I was like, "Fine." So I started by just posting like a few stand-up clips and. Right. And then one of them got a little traction, and then you kind of get addicted to it.
No, that is the truth.
It is. It's a super addictive platform. So then I was just like, well, I guess I'll start dipping my toe. Eventually I ran out of stand-up clips to post. So I was like, I guess I'll start, dipping my toes in, making character stuff, making sort of just like my set, like filming myself, because my background is in like sketch comedy and characters, So it was a platform that made a lot of sense to me once I got the hang of it. But I didn't expect the big following or the like. That was all. I was just having fun making weird videos, And I feel like that's often when success happens, right? When you're just like, I'll just try this thing because it's fun for me. And it's been really like so exciting and surprising.
Are you a depressed bag of crap who can't seem to get over your case of the saddies? Well, buckle in, Dumbo. It's time to pull yourself up by the croc straps and follow me to Happy Town.
I'm so happy.
If you feel sad, you might just be dehydrated. Try drinking a big cold glass of vodka. Another great way to turn that frown upside down is to put on a hot shower and write fun messages in the mirror. And finally, listen to the wise words of the sage man who cut in front of me at the grocery store yesterday. Why don't you just smile more, you stupid cunt?
It's great. Like, it is so... I was on Instagram, and I think I went back to what might have been your first reel. And I don't know if you remember this.
Well, it was...
Or like maybe it's like your first comedy.
I don't.
It's about proposals.
Yes. It actually got muted on TikTok because it's dirty. Yeah, that
really?
Was my first reel. Yeah, because I guess I say pussy.
Yeah. In a very in a very very interesting way, you say pussy, and I was doing research and I died. I watched that like 47 times. Like,
really?
Legitimately, yes. If you go back, I mean, you'll see, because I'm sure you track it on a spreadsheet, all of your views. But yeah, you will see. I died watching that. And it's, but then there's such organic growth to your content. And I think that's like really it's fun for me to see and just spend hours in bed just like, oh my God, look at this. And like, look. But
That's really nice to hear. It's been an interesting because it's all just been kind of trial and error, you know, and it takes time on with anything to figure out what works and what doesn't work and, you know, kind of like hone in on the voice. But it's been so fun. Yeah.
So how long have you been doing stand up, like actual stand up comedy?
Stand up, I think like six years, but I've been doing comedy for like 15 years. Like I started doing sketch in New York when I graduated with, you know, with Rachel. And
was that Skinny Bitch Jesus meeting?
And yes.
Skinny Bitch Jeans and all that?
Skinny Bitch Jesus meeting, the name of my sketch group with my... still comedy partner, Katie Hartman, who we all went to school with. And so we had been performing in New York for years and years. And then I moved to LA and she's still in New York. So I think when I got out here, I was like, I got to figure out a way to like continue performing because I, turns out I get really sad when I'm not.
Who knew?
Okay.
Well, that's a good question. Like, when did you, like, we're going to take it back and then we're going to jump back, but let's take it back. When did you realize that like you had to perform? Like as a kid, were you always performing? Were you the theater kid? What is it?
Yeah. What's I was the a origin theater of that? Kid. I think I started performing when I was in like third grade or something like at the, you know, at the talent show. I did a monologue from this like terrible like children's monologue book.
of monologues in the book. You're like, all right, female, 5 years old. That's a good one.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was like this piece that was just like, I'm becoming my mother. Like I, like all of these like things. Like I'm starting to write things on old envelopes. I don't know why I remember that, but it was like I did this at my elementary school talent show and so like embarrassing in retrospect, but I was just like, you know, it was a thing where like all the parents loved it and all kids were like, what the fuck is this?
And yet I see some influence of that on your in your character work now where you're like trying to get to these characters all because of that monologue book.
I know.
Somebody's like, listening to this and they're throwing away that book right now. Like, I'll never book an audition with this.
Burning it.
Yeah,
burn
exactly.
That book.
Yeah.
No, but I was super, I was like painfully shy.
Really?
Yeah. And so for whatever reason, like, performing was like the outlet where it was just like, oh, I can be alive and I can, you know, it was just a way to like get myself out there.
I thought that you had been doing stand-up for longer. And I think just from the clips that I've seen and obviously watching you perform, like you seem so secure on stage and you're secure in like your voice, which is that thing that everybody talks about. Like, you know, if you talk to comedians who've been doing, I think, feel like the older generation, they say like, it takes 10 years to find your voice. Like,
yeah.
But
yeah, well,
you seem like you've got it. Yeah, no worries.
Thanks for saying that. I mean, I and that's Like I said, like I've been doing comedy for 15 years, and even though the medium of stand up is on the newer side, you know, for like, as they say, like you got to do it 10 years. Like developing a voice and being comfortable on stage. Like I kind of had that when I started stand up because I had all these years of being on stage and writing comedy. So I knew what I thought was funny.
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to watch. Cause are you ever intimidated when you go up, like when you go up on stage, you're on a big lineup. Are you ever intimidated by the other comics?
I'm intimidated all the time. I feel like I'm every second of my life.
You're just like always.
I'm like a walking ball of anxiety. Like everything intimidates me. I constantly feel like imposter syndrome all the time. And I don't know if that ever goes away. I don't know if it ever will. and I don't think that that's. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it. I don't really want to get relaxed about it necessarily. Like I think it's. I think it's good to be nervous and it's good to keep pushing through all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there's a healthy amount of that that is good.
Is there a healthy thing in stand-up? Like, I feel like stand-up is not a healthy thing in general, but it doesn't seem like the most healthy thing. I'm not gonna lie.
No.
Yeah.
Well, but it's good that you're trying to find out. What do you mean by
that? Well, as somebody who's really just started, some of the things that I've noticed and I watch people, like, for example, content. Like, you're on social media. Like, you are pumping out content and doing it at a very high level in the sense of, like, you've got such a strong following. And there are so many people who are trying to, like, you know, they're addicted to it. They're pumping out content. And it's like, you're pumping out stuff. Like, you can't be happy. I know people who talk about, like, checking how many views does this reel have? And like, that's not healthy, but there is that thing of comedy. It's like, I need that instant gratification. Yeah. And so how do you balance that? I mean, you're talking about being a walking ball of anxiety. That's gotta be tough.
Yeah, well, that's, I've always been like that. So it's, there's, in terms of like the balance, I think it is hard. It's hard with social media because it is like you have your phone in your hand and you really have to like I sometimes have to like consciously be like, okay, I'm putting my phone in the other room and I'm just going to like not look at it for an hour, you know, because I sat down to try to write and yet every 2 seconds I'm like picking up my phone and it is super unhealthy. But I think that, you know, the work part of it, the finding fun things to like write and make and, you know, getting on stage and having a fun performance, like that's the joy. That's like, there's nothing in the world that is like that. That's what drives me.
I mean, I absolutely understand that. I feel like people don't realize how therapeutic comedy can be. You know, for me, I only feel like myself truly when I'm on stage. And when I'm on that mic. And so it's always weird when somebody says like, oh, it takes 10 years to find your voice, which I don't necessarily think is true. I think that you can find your voice faster if you know who you are, right? Like Sam Jay, the great comedian, she got a special very quickly. And I was listening to an interview with her and she talked about how she's like, yeah, if you're 18 and you're starting to do comedy, it's going to take you a long time because you're doing it to hang out with your friends and all that stuff. But if you're a little bit older and more aware of who you are as a person, then it's not going to take that time. And so, people always ask me, they're like, why do you do it? And I'm like, it's therapeutic. And like, what? But it's always nice to hear somebody, you know, echo that. So I don't feel crazy myself.
Yeah. I think that that's totally right. And I think that that's totally correct for you where like, you've been doing it for how long?
Like a year and a half at this point.
I mean, that's insane. And you're like, you're so funny and you do have like such a voice and it's like, that isn't the norm. But I think that what you're saying about like starting a bit later in life when you've had the time, like to become an adult and to know yourself can make a huge difference. I mean, it also helps that you're like funny.
It's the trauma, but
yeah.
Do want to go back to your origin because you started doing sketch and everything at Sarah Lawrence in New York, right?
Yeah.
And so you didn't start doing stand-up until you came to LA. Can you talk about the difference when you started in sketch and you're performing versus doing stand-up in Los Angeles? Because there's two different worlds there, mm-hmm. both in the physical and sort of in the artistic space.
Yeah, I mean, obviously sketch and stand-up are very different mediums for all the obvious reasons. I started doing sketch comedy right out of college. Actually, my last year in college, there was a sketch group that that then a bunch of us moved to New York and started this this very large sketch group called The Impending Mustache. what a perfect name for a sketch comedy group right out of college.
I love it.
And we were performing in, like, you know, these little shitty theaters in, you know, deep in Brooklyn. I was at that point just acting, because I hadn't really written, and I very much considered myself an actor who was just, like, doing this as, like, a way to start my career as, like, a big time, I don't know, Shakespearean actress, I guess, is what I wanted at the time. And then Katie Hartman, who was in the group with me, we kind of started writing together, and we always just had, like, such great chemistry. I always, like, just thought she was the funniest person on earth.
Love it.
Still do. And eventually the group kind of whittled down, and eventually we broke off and just started writing and performing our own stuff. It was all very character-based, very very silly, absurd, dark, weird, dirty. it was the best. Like, we performed all over New York. We had, like, a monthly show at the Pit, the People's Improv Theater. And we traveled all over. We did, like, a ton of festivals. We went to Edinburgh two summers.
You performed the show in Edinburgh twice?
We did our show two summers in a row. In, like, the first year we did it, we were in these caves that had been sort of converted into a theater, but it was just, like, literally, like, a dripping cave. We had a midnight show for, you know, all of August. Every night we would do our show at midnight, and it was the best time ever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Just pure joy at that point.
It was pure joy. And I think it really, like, you know, those, having that time to just, like, perform every day really solidified us as performers and as a duo. And Katie is still my comedy and writing partner. But I moved to LA in 2014, I don't know.
I mean, I just know things is pre-pandemic life. So, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
That's how I do things, yeah.
Yeah, at some point my husband and I moved to LA. There were a couple years where I was just like, I don't know what to do with myself. And I was kind of dipping my toes in, like, sketch stuff, but it just wasn't, when you find that person that is, like, the person you want to perform with,
yeah.
I couldn't go back to doing, like, regular sketch comedy. I just didn't feel, like, inspired to do it or to, like, work with anybody. And then I just started doing stand-up. And,
that's the hard part to me. Like, that's the crazy part. You were like, I'm not inspired to do anything, so I'm just going to, I'm going out on my own.
Well, it was, you know, stand-up was something I think that doing sketch as a duo in New York, we were immersed in a lot of the stand-up scene in New York.
Sure.
Also, because we would do a lot of, like, we would be on a lot of stand-up lineups.
Yeah.
I mean, it was often, like, very weird, and many times it didn't work.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can imagine having, like, sketch in the middle of a stand-up show is not.
And people don't understand that, because they think, like, comedy's comedy, but they don't understand, like, there is very much an art to all of this. This is not just people just going up there and, you know, being funny off the top of their head. But
yeah, it has to be framed in the right way.
Yeah.
And I think that we, by, like, you know, in the later years of New York, I think that we kind of had figured it out. We had figured out what pieces would work in rooms like that. But it wasn't always easy. And so I had a ton of stand-up friends. And but it also 1,000% felt like starting from scratch in a lot of ways.
Sure.
because it is an, it's like such a new muscle. You're speaking as yourself. You're not speaking as a character. You're the work is a lot more personal. The writing is very different. The performing is very different. But I think there were some things that I was still able to take and make that crossover.
Do you feel like coming out of New York just as a performer helped you at all in Los Angeles?
Yes. As opposed to coming from a different city, or?
Well, you know, I think there's that thing, especially in stand-up in New York, right? When you talk to comedians, they talk about, like, when you go on stage in New York, you have to bring it, jokes. You got it. It's no nonsense. I'm here to tell jokes. You know, I get up there, I touch the mic, the joke comes, and I got to keep it rolling. And I think that in LA, from what I've noticed, there's a little bit more like narrative based, more of like, this is who I am first. Like I see comedians do crowd work, like as soon as they touch the mic, and I'm like, wait, but when are you going to tell a joke? And there's very different styles. So I was just wondering if even just doing sketch in New York sort of helped you in LA as you just kind of, you know, approach the scene, even just starting over, as you said.
I mean, I like to think so. I've seen a lot of stand-up in New York. I haven't really done stand-up in New York at all. One or two shows since I have moved out to LA. I think that one of the biggest things that helped me as I started stand-up was that I knew how to bomb. That it didn't kill me because I had so many years of trial and error of like doing shows to two people or doing shows to a room full of people in silence. Right. So I sort of had that armor already. And not to say that it doesn't, like, it still hurts to have a terrible show. Like that feeling is still, but I think that I had the tools to know how to muddle through that and just like get up and be like, okay, well, I had one bad show, so when's the next one?
So of course we have to ask, what does bombing feel like to you? Everybody has like a different description of like what bombing feels like. And then also, can you remember, like, do you have like the worst bombing story? Like if I say bomb to you, like on stage bombing, is there one story that pops in your head immediately?
There's two, and they're both, there's a few. So bombing with sketch, with Katie, with our sketch duo, we were asked to perform at the intermission of the National Roller Derby Tournament. In Philadelphia.
This already sounds like when you took this gig, you were like, this, did you think this is gonna be good, or were you just like,
we thought it was gonna, like, we were like, so excited about it. We thought this was like we have arrived, we are the entertainment portion of the National Roller Derby Tournament.
They will stop and pay attention to us as we
like, we were so excited. And it was in this massive arena, like this massive stadium. And we were doing this sketch where we dressed up as nuns and sang a song about like kidnapping children in the woods.
Oh, Jesus, look at them all. What are all you little babies doing out here all alone in the middle of the woods? In the middle of the night. Welcome, children, dirty children. Are you rather lost?
And so we just like came out into this arena of like full of like mostly women who were there to see, you know, like these badass women to see like the roller derby, around. And we like in these like nun costumes, and then we sang our song into the microphone.
Who here is an orphan?
Raise your hand,
in the wee air off your hair, and if you
there's one in the wee little side.
Way we in the middle, in the wee middle,
in the wee little side back,
in the wee middle, in the wee side, in the wee. No, wait, all of them are
No.
Wait, Sister Beefcake, do you think?
No.
Are you those brave young orphans who escaped that tragic fire from that orphanage not 20 miles down the road?
I feel like we got, I don't think we actually got booed, but like my memory is of getting booed.
Like your internal memory, like, no, I definitely. You would watch the tape back, you're like, oh wow, nobody was booing. That was just my subconscious booing me. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, all right, so you're singing these songs, you look out, what do you see looking back at you? Like, what does this look like?
Just blank. I feel like it was just like, I mean, I think like a lot of people weren't even paying attention.
Right.
Like they just had like clocked out. And it was just blank faces. Like nobody was smiling. Nobody was even like.
Yeah. They were just like, what is happening? Now.
Yeah.
I'm also imagining like a long walk back to like a dressing room in these nun costumes. Like you have to cross the rink to like.
Yeah. Yeah, we had to cross the whole arena, pick up the dresses. Like, I mean, like, I don't remember a lot of it, but I feel like I remember like sitting in the room that they had, you know, like the green room, just like quietly with Katie, just being like, wow, that was not what we hoped for.
You have like friends text messaging you, how was it? You're like, still processing.
Still processing. Give me like a second to this day, still processing.
Yeah, harmony's on point, but
but like that, like also, the great thing about having a partner is that like bombing together, we had each other. You know, like when you bomb in stand up, you're just like, you're just alone with yourself.
You're just up there.
There's no one to be like, man, that sucked, right? Yeah, that sucked. You know.
People will tell you when you come off, though. Other comedians be like, yeah, good set, man. You're like, that was not, that's the one I hate the most, right? The, hey, good set. Like, don't look at me like I just survived war. Like hey, you gave it your all. It's like, did I?
Yeah. That was courageous. Yeah.
At least you did it. That's the other one. At least you did it. Like, that was your make-a-wish moment is what that feels like. Like, yeah, thank you.
Right. Yeah, you're putting in the you're putting in the time.
Hey, we all, you know. This happens to the best of us. What does bombing feel like to you when you're on stage by yourself? You're just there. It's not going the way you want. Like, how would you describe that feeling?
Bad. The worst feeling of all time. Bad. I mean,
it is.
It's almost like out of body, right? Where it's just like you're, I don't know, it's just brutal. I mean, it's brutal. Amen. Like, someone told me, maybe it was my brother. So my younger brother is also a comedian. He lives in Cincinnati. And, he gave me a really good piece of advice, and I don't know where he heard it, but he was like, if you're bombing, you just have to, like, the instinct is to just, like, start going faster, and what you actually need to do is slow down. Lately, that's what I've been trying to do, is, like, slow down and just, like, come back to being present, because it's really hard to, like, get out of your head in those moments, because you're just like, I'm failing, I'm bombing, this feels terrible, like, and you can't think about anything else.
Yes.
But what you have to do is just, like, be present in the room. And sometimes you're just gonna bomb and there's nothing that can be done about it. And like, it's not necessarily even a bad thing. It's just like, this is maybe not your audience and that's okay. Like, not every audience should be your audience.
That's a very good point. I just heard, and I can't remember who I heard say this, but they said, you know, if you're in a room with 100 people and you're telling jokes and only 3 people are laughing, that's your audience. And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It's just like, that's your audience. Like, don't throw it all away because there's 3 people really enjoying it there.
Well, I think about that a lot, like starting to like travel a bit more and being in cities where it's just like, it's okay if this is not your audience. Like, this is, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like at a bar show, right? Like, you know, I'm in this place where I'm still doing all these bar shows, obviously. And you get like that guy who's gotten his back turned to you. And you're not going to get an applause break when the Laker game is on. You know what I mean? Like, that's not why these people came to this, you know, knockoff Buffalo Wild Wings. They didn't even know it was comedy happening tonight. So my thing is, like, instead of looking for an applause break, if I can just get one guy to turn around and pay attention to me, that's a win. Like, that's a win.
Yeah, totally.
But it takes,
you know. Yeah, you have to, I think that that's a great way to, like, manage expectations. It shouldn't, like, you have to get to a place where that is not, like, hurting your heart, which is hard because I think, you know, I'm a super sensitive person, and I take things on. Like, I, you know, I feel like I did a show recently in the past 6 months, and there was an acquaintance of mine who went on stage before me, and she didn't do great from my vantage point. Sure. And she gets off stage and she was like, "That was fun. They're a fun crowd." And I was like, "That's so cool that like truly no shade. Like, that's so cool that like you're able to just
say that,
not spiral when you don't have like a lights out set and you're just like,
yeah,
that was fine. There were fun moments."
Yeah.
I feel like I'd like to take that on more.
That is something, you know, I watch a lot of my, like, I try and tape everything and I try and watch it all. And I'm trying to find moments. Like, it may not be wall to wall great, but like in a 20-minute set, I'm trying to find 5 good moments. I'm like, "Oh, okay. Like, hey, look, somebody was laughing," or like, you know, whatever it is. Cause you sometimes you just need, it's like life. You just need something to hold on to till your next show. You're like, "I just got to do it again."
Totally. I think it's so easy to just focus on the moments where like it wasn't raucous laughter, or like you messed up a punchline or whatever. And I think it is really important to like refocus. And
yeah, so we talked about you bombing, but now we're gonna give you the high moment real quick, because we can't you know just have talk about that. You just had the pleasure of featuring for Maria Bamford.
And it was the best.
That tell like Maria Bamford, one of the best comedians of all time. You have to, what was that like? And I, you know, you were posting about it on Instagram, your social media, but like, what was that like for you? How did that come about?
It was really surreal. It was, you know, it was like a bucket list thing for me. And it was like as amazing and surreal as I imagined it would be. I actually was like very emotional the whole weekend.
Really?
I kept finding myself in moments where I was like, just like taking it in and like on the verge of tears. She couldn't have been kinder and more generous and lovely. And just like, you know, I waxed about it in my post, but it was also just like, getting to watch her like perform 5 shows in a row, and to like watch how she worked with different audiences. And it was like such a masterclass. It was one of the best weekends ever. Like it, and it felt like I said, just like such a bucket list thing, and such a like, it was just the best.
So you did 5 shows, you said?
Yeah.
And how did you book these 5 shows with Maria? Like, how does that come about?
I was going to be in the Midwest for shows, and I saw that she was at this club, so I just sent a bunch of emails to people just asking. And
is that something that you do like often? Because I think a lot of people don't realize that you have to really hustle. Like, comedy's a hustling game.
Yeah, it's definitely like not a natural thing for me to do. But it is what you have to do. I'm learning, like in the stand-up world, you just have to like ask for things. And that is a muscle of its own. But yeah, I just asked a bunch of people, and it seemed like it wasn't going to happen. And then I got a call, you know, from my manager, and he was like, "Okay, it's booked." So I just asked
how much time
I could
between
think of.
That and booking. Like, how much time from when you first sent that email to?
Oh, I think I had started sending emails out maybe 2 or 3 months before, and then maybe like a month later got word that I had that weekend. So I had lots of time to like stress out about it leading up to it.
You're like on the plane, just like jittery knowing.
yeah.
So you meet her, this is at Helium, is this where this happened?
Yeah, Helium in Indianapolis.
And so did you meet her like in the green room? Like, how did that?
Yeah, and she was just like so nice. Just couldn't have been nicer. Was just like so warm and just like friendly, and also like incredibly generous. Like, upped the pay and is known for that, and is known for being super transparent about money. And you know, at the end of the week, she sent me the breakdown of everything.
Oh wow, that is very kind.
And this is something that she does for everybody. She's like super passionate about transparency, and you know, because features haven't, their pay hasn't been changed in decades. And it's super messed up. I don't know. I'm sure there are other headliners who do similar things, similar bumps, but it was my first experience with that. So I was really blown away and moved by it.
And
doesn't have to, you know?
Yeah. It's very strange that I'm navigating that and understanding it and learning it. And it's a very, you know, for a business that brings so much joy to people, there are some really like sort of just dark sides to it. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned is like the feature pay. Can you, if you don't mind, can you talk about just sort of the overall pay structures and what you've seen in comedy and
yeah. I mean, I'm so used to performing for free because that's just what I've been performing for free for so long that I'm trying to change that mentality in myself, where it's just like, you deserve to get paid. You've been doing this for a long time. You're a professional. Like, I think it's the norm to perform in LA without pay, just because it's like, you know, it's exposure, and that's just the model that's in place, and it sucks, but it's just like, the assumption is that like, well, you're here, you're making money other ways, you know, you're booking work or whatever. I think my instinct is to just be like grateful for any kind of pay, whatever it is. But it is like, if I'm traveling to feature in a different city, getting paid like $100 a show,
right?
It is hard to break even, you know.
Yeah. Because they're not putting you up.
You got to sell a lot of merch. I mean, I'm fortunate that like I have, my family lives in the Midwest, so like I've been going there and being able to like stay there. So I've been making it work, but it's like, how are you supposed to survive until you get to that place where you are headlining? Like, it's not a sustainable model, but you know, what are you going to do? Like,
what can you do? And you either just like buck the system completely or you try and play into it. And when I first realized that about comedy, I mean, it was kind of disgusting. I'll be honest. Like, I remember having this moment sitting on my couch, just like, what? Like, yeah, I get it. As an open mic, you're not going to get paid. And I get, you know, small shows in town, but even a small show in town, you should get something. I mean, you should get something. If people are paying to come see the show, then there needs to be something going out. And it really bothers me, as I've started producing shows especially, but it bothers me when I see other producers who are comedians themselves not giving their comedians anything. And a free drink is not, you're not giving me anything, because the venue is giving me the free drink. You know what I mean? And that, it's just,
totally,
it's really sad.
It is. You know, I don't expect to do, like, even if it's just gas money, like that's not gonna like pay my rent, but like I'm grateful for the token, for the like, it makes me feel like, okay, you're honoring me and honoring the fact that like this is work. Like,
yes,
you know,
yes. And comedians, we don't really get that. I think that speaks to, I think what the public sort of views comedy as. Like, I was talking to somebody just recently, and they didn't realize that we script our jokes. Like, they were like, oh, we just thought like you were just good and you got a Netflix special and you went up there and you just winged it. And I was like, you think that people get paid millions of millions of dollars to just go up there and be like, all right, let's see, what do I want to talk about today? Hold on, let me check my notes. Like, no, it's like we rehearse this all the time.
Yeah.
And we write. Yeah. We're actually intelligent people.
These are jokes like you see a Netflix special and you're like, this is a joke that this person has been working on for years. Like,
yes. For years.
Yeah.
And then you go to a show and then you get one free beer or a well cocktail. And you're like, thank you. Thank you so much for that.
But that's why your shows are so great, Chris, because you're like a producer who cares about the people you book.
I do. I mean, I really care, and it comes down to the fact that I just really love this, and as somebody who wanted to do this thing for so long, and I was so scared to do it. I mean, mm-hmm. when I was a kid, I've talked about this. When I was a kid, I remember when I got my first Dell computer. Right, I got this Dell computer, and it had a DVD drive, and I was like, what? It was crazy. And all I cared about is that it came with this headset that had like a microphone, and I would just walk around my room just pretending to perform for these huge crowds, like with this headset and microphone, like that. That so now being in a place to produce shows, like I appreciate it and love it so much, and I just think like, what would I want? And I want to create a show where the comics want to do the show and the audience wants to show up and enjoy the show, because there is a happy comic is a happy audience, and there's a beautiful relationship between the two, but it's all about respect. It's about treating this like a job and a craft and understanding the work that goes into this. And you know, so who would I be if I didn't try and take care of people to the best of my ability? I mean, even this conversation, I really want to do this. I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't think any of us know what we're doing. So, but you have to just start, right?
And I think that we know more than we think we do, you know, also.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, it is like any new endeavor is, there's going to be a learning curve. But like, I think if you have the instinct to do something, then you have some kind of understanding inside of you of what it looks like. And like, it's going to take a little bit of time for that to like fully flower. But
there's always reasons why we shouldn't do something. But then mm-hmm. oftentimes, especially with something like comedy or whatever your dream may be that you want to go after, the reason why you should do it is because you want to be happy.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how we would just put that happiness in a box and just go chase something completely different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can I ask, what was the thing that that made you like pull the trigger and get up on stage for the first time?
So I got to take this back to a relationship that I was in. I was at my 2-year anniversary dinner. It was like this spectacular night. It was like all planned and like, yeah. And we got in this conversation, my ex and I got in this conversation. I said, you know, I think I really want to pursue stand-up comedy. And she was like, I couldn't be with the comic. I don't like that lifestyle. Like, I just couldn't be with the comic. And I remember just feeling crushed. And the best part about it is, and this is, of course, the comedy in the situation, it's like, she's like, I just don't think I could be with a comic. And I just remember like looking at her and like nodding, and in the corner of my eye, seeing the waiter like bring the two dishes and like put them down and be like, so how is everything? And I was like, we're fine. It's like, do you need another drink? And it was like both of us at the same time, like, yes. And at that moment I knew like this night was like done. And I suppressed this thing of wanting to be a comedian because I like wanted to be in this like relationship. And I thought that's what I should mm-hmm. be. And so, of course, after like 5 years of really being somebody I wasn't, is really what that comes down to, and just trying to fit in a space that I was never going to fit into, you know, we broke up, and the pandemic hits, and I'm in school, and I start working at this radio station. I start working at KCSB, and I being on the microphone and just talking and being around people and seeing younger people, because I'm going back to school in like, you know, my 30s. And being mm-hmm. around younger people who are just sometimes blindly just doing what they want, right? Like the world hasn't sort of like, you know, stuffed them down with all this craziness, right? They're just out there living their lives. I was like, well, hold on, wait, I want to do this. So I saw this ad on Instagram, or this thing about like an open mic. And so I was like, I'm going. So that morning, I found out like the night before. So then that morning comes and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna write some jokes. So I write some jokes down and I'm gonna go to this open mic. And I get there that night. I'm so excited. And I get there and I'm sitting around the comedians. I can see who the comedians are. And this was this open mic that would get like 50 audience members. It was more like a showcase here in town. It was really cool. And there were some really funny people and some not so funny people, and cool. But I'm gonna do it. But I'm too scared to put my name down on this list. And I'm drinking these beers, and now I'm drunk. And the woman who runs it, Sue Scaduto, I have to give her credit. She sees me and she's like, do you want to go on stage? I was like, yeah, but no, I'm not. She's like, oh, well, we only have two comedians left. I'm like, well, So I was like, no, I'm not going to. She's like, you sure? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, no, I'm not going to. So now here's that fear once again. It's like, and I'm drunk. And it's like, I'm like, no, I'm not going to. So the two comedians go up, and then she goes up, and she's like, all right, well, we have one more comedian for the night. He's gonna wing it. He's from Los Angeles, Chris Williams.
Oh, shit.
Like, what? So I hear my name get called, and I'm like, oh, my God. So I got to go up there, right? Like, I can't back down now. And on the way up there, she says, you have 7 minutes. And I was like, seven minutes? My God.
7 minutes at an open mic?
Yeah.
That's unheard of.
At an open mic. It's right? And I'm thinking, like, I only have maybe, like, 2 minutes of jokes. She let me talk for 11 minutes and 34 seconds. And I was funny. Like, I was really funny. And in that moment, I still have the recording. It's on my website, actually. In that moment, my world just changed. Everything changed. And every fear that I ever had about wanting to go after something, it was thrown out because this is the thing I wanted to do since I was a kid. And I was like, I'm doing it. And people don't understand now. Like, yes, I graduated college. And it's very strange when you go back to college in your 30s and you tell your parents, I want to be a stand-up comedian. They're like, okay. Lord. But like, that was the biggest fear. And now that I'm doing it, I just refuse to do anything else. Like, I just refuse.
Yeah.
And it was just that thing of like watching the world be in this crazy place and also just like gaining a little bit of confidence in these small wins. And that was it. But I do remember That's telling amazing. My parents, thank you. I remember telling my parents like, yeah, I want to be a stand-up comedian. And they're like, yeah, okay. Yeah. Like, cool, yeah. Okay, cool. How's school going? Like, all right. And that was like, I don't think people understand what it really entails. My mom thankfully has read like every like stand-up comedian's like book. So she was like, you know, Kevin Hart used to have to drive from here to here. And so she kind of understands it, but.
Did she read the books before knowing that you were doing stand-up?
No, she read them before. Like she just, you know, like Trevor Noah's Born a Crime and she just likes, you know, like those people. Yeah. So there was some contention like sort of towards the end of me being in school because they were like gigs that I was booking like during finals. And my mom was like, but it's finals. I'm like, Mom, I don't care. Like I'm gonna graduate. I want to go drive 80 miles to do these 5 minutes. She's like, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. And it makes no sense. And you can't describe that to somebody. Like they just don't understand the world, but they want me to be happy. And they constantly talk about, you know, when I was a kid and I would perform like these one person shows in my bedroom and I'd make these flyers and stuff like that. And that's kind of the fun of producing Let Loose is it reminds me of being a kid and like, you know, making these flyers and putting on the thing and hosting and all that. So totally. The fact that I'm happy brings them joy, but
I love that.
Yeah. I get a lot of support, but when you decided that you were going to like do this, like this was the thing, like, wait, so you have a younger brother. Was he already doing comedy? Mm-hmm.
He was. Oh, he was doing stand-up. He started doing stand-up when I was still in New York doing sketch comedy. Kind of a similar thing where he was on a very different path. He went to grad school. He got like his master's in English. He was going to do the like teaching route. And I think he kept kind of seeing me doing comedy in New York. And I would have these conversations with him where he would be like, I really want to do comedy, but I'm too scared. Like, and then eventually he just like took the leap and he started doing stand-up in Cincinnati. And really helped that scene in Cincinnati grow from the ground up. I mean,
really?
that scene is incredible. There's like such great comics there, such great indie shows, also like a couple great clubs. But and he's now been doing it for I don't know, over 10 years. I don't know how long, but
so he just found his voice. Good.
Just found his voice. No, he's hilarious, and we like often write together and bounce jokes off of each other. And he's actually been super helpful to me on my, you know, stand-up journey, especially kind of starting to do club stuff because he's been like in the club circuit for a while now. And he, I feel like has a good grasp on it. And
you're getting ready to do some shows with him, right? Are you co-headlining? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, we're starting to co-headline. We have a couple big dates. We're going to be back in Indianapolis at Helium on August 21st.
Yeah.
And then we're co-headlining the Columbus Funny Bone on August 28th, which is...
That's awesome.
Which is, like, pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's a funny bone. Like, what? So you had support, obviously, from sort of the get-go. Like, was your...
Yeah.
Were your family, yeah, were they supportive too?
They've always been super supportive. And for, like, I have been performing and wanting this to be my career since high school. And they've been supportive of it the whole time, which I think is rare. And I'm very, very grateful for.
Yeah.
Because God knows it's been a long journey.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the, was there a moment when you thought, like, I can say I'm going to do this for the rest of my life?
I don't think I ever thought I would stop doing this. I mean, there have been dark days where I've been like, I've been doing this for over a decade and nothing is happening. So yeah. should I pivot? I still feel, I don't think I feel that sense of like, I have arrived. I don't think I've ever felt that, but I certainly in the past year, things have started happening that make it feel like there's momentum, for the first time in a long time. And that feels really good because, it's been a long fucking time.
Like,
I've been doing this for a long ass time.
So all it took was for people to die off in large scale. And then here you are, things are moving.
All it took was a global pandemic and a little thing called TikTok.
That's it. That's it. That's all.
Who knew?
Who knew? Oh, how the world works in mischievous ways. what was it like when you saw your first like TikTok, like go, like I'm talking about like really go, like go, you're like watching it and just all of a sudden, you remember the first one that just went crazy? I mean, your characters are incredible. Like I mentioned, they just crack me up. It's ridiculous. The out of touch rich lady is, I mean, it's who I aspire to be. But you know, in my real life, I'm just trying to be an out of touch rich white woman. That's my goal. People are breaking down those barriers for me right now. So, but where does that character come from?
I think it's fun to play high status, wealthy person. And I think the instinct is to play them like not kind, mm-hmm, and like snobby. And I just thought like it would be fun to kind of like turn that on its head a little bit, and just this person who had been so sheltered that she doesn't even know this, like can't place like the most basic things.
Did you know there is a VIP list for people who aren't VIPs? It's called Craig's List. I said to my assistant, who is this Craig? And how do I get on that list? So she takes me to this place on the World Wide Web that is like a virtual garbage dump for people who don't have trust funds. They have everything you could never want. Couches covered in cat hair, mattresses covered in dog hair, men covered in man hair. They even have something called jobs. I didn't find one of those, but I did find someone to come over and tickle my toes at a very reasonable price.
So it just became like a game for me that was like very easy to hook into.
Yeah.
It's been fun, but now I'm just like, I've run out of ideas.
So it's interesting because not only did it catch on, but I it caught on to me because it's such a great time to make fun of the rich. Like, really, I mean, this is this time where we're like, the poor are so poor, and you know, but to just make light of it and to do it in a way that you do. I mean, obviously the great character actors, you play the character so straight, right? You can't play the joke. You have to play the character, and you do it just so well in those clips. But I want to know one last thing. There's just one last thing that I have to know. And that is, how has your comedy changed in the 6 years you've been doing it? And where would you like, what are you working on right now? When you go on stage, is there something you're working on, something you want to sort of add to your comedy arsenal?
My like stand-up brain and my like character TikTok, Instagram reel, sketch brain feel kind of at odds in my head. So finding ways to like bring those together a bit more, like bring a little bit more of the like silly character stuff into my stand-up, like, you know, I don't want to get on stage and like start doing impressions, but I feel like there is stuff to be
I just see it now.
To be mined.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially as like that audience, and I don't know, maybe this isn't something that I need to think about or worry about, but like as my online audience grows and that audience starts coming to shows, I have this like thing in my head. Well, like, are they expecting to see what they see online, and do I need to like be thinking about that? And I don't really know the answer to that question,
yeah,
but
tough.
Or if it is even necessary to bridge that. I think it would be fun
right.
to find more ways to like incorporate more like character stuff into my stand-up, but I'm gonna keep playing with that.
Yeah.
How has my stand-up changed? I think in the last 6 years, I think I've been working to have like cleaner sets.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're trying to make money, I see. Okay.
Yeah, just because like I would like to like, you know, get a late night set and like not necessarily because I think cleaner things are funnier. I quite the contrary, but in an attempt to get some money.
Yeah, it'd be nice, right? Well, Leah, thank you so much for spending this time with me, for coming to talk to me here and just, you know, talking about your journey in comedy. And you know, I'm just such a huge fan. You're so funny. I love your content. And just thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. And I'm obviously right back at you, a huge fan of yours. So this was really a pleasure. It went by in a flash.
Right? Not too bad. And you have, you have a bunch of dates coming up. Where can people see you doing your thing? What's the next one? What's the big stuff?
Yeah, I have a bunch of shows, and they're all on my website, leahrudick.com. But some fun ones coming up. Doing some Midwest shows. My brother and I are co-headlining a show at Helium in Indianapolis on August 21st. And then co-headlining the Funny Bone in Columbus on August 28th. Yeah. Oh, also Vero Beach, Florida, September 16th and 17th.
Okay. So. Awesome. Well, I look forward to hearing about all the shows. And thank you once again. You are the best. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Cool.
Well, that was my conversation with Leah Rudick. And I have to tell you, it went by way faster than I thought it would because Leah is amazing. I need to give Leah a very special thank you for being the first guest on Funny Business. I didn't even have to beg her. She said yes the first time. I was actually kind of surprised, I'm not going to lie to you. Leah is incredible, and like I said, please follow her on Twitter and TikTok, at Leah Rudick. Follow her on Instagram, at Leah_Rudick, and check out her first comedy special, which is streaming on Seed and Spark. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram, at Let Loose Comedy SB, and check out our website, letloosecomedy.com. Let Loose Comedy's Funny Business is a We the Village Media production, and we were produced by Daniel Husseas, with music by Philip E. Morris. Daniel, you're amazing. Thank you so much. I hope that stays in this. Make sure to rate this podcast and share, because we want more people to hear it. Once again, I'm Chris Williams, and this has been Funny Business.